outside of mega wealthy people, a lot of millionaires are actually blue collar workers who you wouldn't normally associate that with. So a lot of this is kind of, who do you hang out with? What kind of person are you? Do you have an outer scorecard versus an inner scorecard? I think that's really important, because a lot of us, we should be motivated internally, what is important to us, and peace of mind. I mean, you mentioned SWAN, sleep well at night. I mean, peace of mind, we should value peace of mind highly, which is part of an inner scorecard. Are we doing things we like with people we like, as opposed to an outer scorecard where we're trying to impress others?
Hi, I'm Mike Abel. I'm a business, marketing, and communications specialist and the founder of MNC Saatchi Abel. I'm a family man, a problem solver, a futurist, an optimist at heart. Welcome to my podcast, Willing and Able, the home of hopeful conversations that challenge perspectives. It's a continuation of the ideas and conversations I began in my book, Willing and Able, Lessons from a Decade in Crisis. My guest today is close friend and business associate, Stephen Nathan, a numbers guy with over three decades of experience in finance. In 2005, Stephen founded 10X Investments, a financial services company focused on providing higher retirement returns with lower fees. Now he's exploring new ventures in the United States as the CFO of HealthQuest Global and joins me in the leadership team at Sense as a non-executive director of a disruptive market research company based in Ireland. And in between all of that, he leads a successful family office business called SWAN, an acronym for Sleep Well at Night. Welcome, Stephen. Fantastic to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Mike.
So, I've just described you as a numbers guy, but what do you think makes you slightly different, or very different, from other CAs and CFAs?
Yeah, you're never sure if it's a compliment to be told a numbers guy, but numbers have always interested me, but more specifically, finance has interested me, the world of finance. You know, growing up, I didn't grow up with a lot of money in a household with a lot of money or with investments. It wasn't a topic of conversation, but it was always interesting to me. You know, how does money work? How does money work? How do interest rates work? How does the stock market work? All of that. And in South Africa, when I went to university, you didn't have a broad range of choices. I mean, there's much more choice today. So it was kind of, if you were going to do numbers and finance, it was more or less a chartered accounting route to go. That was kind of, and it was almost like a ticket to get into the world of finance. So that's kind of the background. But I do like, through my experiences, I kind of like to try and simplify things. And if I look at sort of the world around me in the business world, maybe the world in general outside of business, you kind of, like, there's three buckets I look at. There's people who are involved in problem solving, solving a problem. A great example are engineers. I mean, if you're going to build a bridge, the bridge is either going to stand or fall with the weight over time, or you're going to build a dam. Or if you look at finance, you're trying to solve a financial problem. Those are the kind of problems that interest me. Then you get people who are sort of in the world of opinion. so excuse me.
Increasingly, with social media and everything else.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of an opinion, like law. I thought law was quite factual based until I was involved in some legal cases. And then it's about opinion. It's about the argument one can make around it. And politicians, I think, are in the business of opinion. And then thirdly, you have the world of psychology, sort of consumer behavior. Obviously, that's a lot of your world is in around perceptions and storytelling and understanding and molding perceptions. And for me, it's always been about, I like the problem-solving side, but I'm learning that life is much broader than just the logic. We need to be far more emotional and in tune with people's feelings more than what logic tells us to do.
Well, that's really interesting, because I think you've more than answered what makes you different, because you talk to, in all aspects of that, the human condition and the motivations, and understanding the motivations to help people make better decisions. Because what I find in the investment industry so often is it's about selling products as opposed to understanding the underlying needs and hopes and dreams of the warm-bodied person that you're talking to. What do you think it is, though? Because similarly to you, you know, I don't come from a wealthy family per se. I'd say a comfortable family, but certainly not wealthy. But my grandfather, who was a dentist and maxillofacial surgeon, loved to play the stock market. And so from a very early age, I'd say from probably 11 or 12 years old, I read the Financial Mail religiously every Friday night that I used to go to them for dinner. And that helped me enormously. When did you start reading about finance and actually getting involved? Because you said it always fascinated you. How did that fascination manifest?
So when I was still at high school, I started reading books. I wasn't actually a big reader of the stock market. So as you say, a lot of people like to buy shares. That wasn't really my fascination. My fascination was more of a bigger picture. So there were some great books written in the 70s and the 80s about things like management buyouts. So the first management buyouts and the first leverage buyouts. And there was a very well-known book called Barbarians at the Gate, which
is
about
it.
The biggest.
Nabisco.
RJ Nabisco, the takeover with KKR. It just seemed a very exciting, fascinating world.
Yes.
And then it's trying to understand, well, how do you raise money? What is an interesting opportunity? Why can some companies raise money and others can't?
Yes.
Why can some governments raise money more cheaply than others? It was more a fascination with what I'd call the macro, the bigger picture, as opposed to picking shares. I've never been that interested in picking shares, which for a lot of people is fun, but it's quite speculative.
yeah. And I think as you've taught me over the years, for somebody to be winning on one share, it's likely that somebody's losing on another. And I don't think that people understand that equation.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's called a zero-sum game. A lot of things, and especially in finance, superficially, they sound wonderful. So when someone says it to you, you know, it does something in our brain that says, well, that sounds sensible. So a fund manager will say things like, we have a fantastic research team and we go and visit management and we have artificial intelligence, which tells us how many cars are parked out of a shopping center, which is very much storytelling. And they say, basically, it allows us to identify great companies, which we own, and lousy companies, which we sell. And you go, and by doing that, we generate fantastic returns.
Yes.
And you go, well, I'm in.
Of course.
Well, I'm in. But what you don't understand and what they don't tell you is that for every person who buys a share, so let's say you bought Apple or Tesla or whatever, if you bought it, someone sold it.
Yes.
So even as we speak around the world, billions of dollars are being traded, bought and sold. And a seemingly smart person is buying a share and a seemingly smart person is selling the same share at the same price.
Yes.
They both can't be right. And that's the zero-sum game. So if I did well because my fund manager invested in Apple in an early stage, you know, I might have outperformed the index and my peer group. But equally so, someone else doesn't have it in their portfolio and they underperform me. That's the zero-sum game, which no one really tells you about. But it doesn't stop there. It's not a zero-sum game. Because if there were no cost in the system, you'd say, okay, well, it's not so bad. Because on average, you know, investors, some of us are going to lose and some of us are going to win. It's a bit like going to the casino and saying, well, you know, if the casino didn't take anything, we'd be okay over here. But you've got transaction costs.
Yeah.
You know, investment banks exist and stock exchanges exist because they charge you fees.
Yes.
Every time you buy a share in South Africa, you pay 0.25% tax to the government. There's market impact costs. So basically what happens is that the more active a fund manager is and the more people are buying and selling, while it might create interesting headlines and news stories, the worse you are as an investor because you can only earn the return on the market less the total cost of investing. And the higher that aggregate cost is, the worse you are. And that's also a little bit of something where you've got to think about it because the financial services industry doesn't add to your return. It subtracts from the return. But people think it adds to the return.
Yes.
They go, oh, I don't want to mention any names here. But, you know, XYZ fund manager gave me 11% this year. They didn't give you anything. The stock market would have given that to you. The stock market earns a return and it's corporate America and corporate South Africa and good companies that are generating the wealth.
Yes.
And your investments is kind of, what kind of access do I have to those and at what cost?
Yes.
You've just got to come into investing with a skeptical mind and to scratch a little bit beneath the surface and ask the simple questions. Because so often people don't ask the simple questions, A, because they think, well, maybe I'm going to embarrass myself. But ask something that's so obvious and you don't want to be thought of as not sophisticated or not understanding it. So people are intimidated, but you've got to ask the simple questions.
Yeah.
And one of the things, I mean, we speak about retirement and why we started 10X is because retirement is the biggest savings pot in any country, the retirement assets, because for most people, your pension fund is what you're going to be relying on almost exclusively for your retirement.
Yeah.
So you get like one shot at it.
Yeah.
But if you look around the world, in every country in the world, people are underfunded. Doesn't matter where you are, even in the richest countries. Just like, how much are you underfunded?
Well, I think what I want to do, because this is absolutely vitally important stuff you're saying here, is almost take a bit of a leap back. And I think that the interesting thing in the world today is, and for always really, is there's always such a small percentage of people that can afford to retire one day. And that is because they're not focused on their retirement and they live in the day. And there's nothing wrong with living in the day, living in the moment and maximizing your life. That's exactly what you should do. But you also do need to think about tomorrow. What do you think it is? Because there are going to be a lot of people listening to this right now that haven't put away a cent for their retirement or are earning big salaries and spending everything on overt consumerism, whether it's fancy cars or fancy clothing or fancy restaurants or fancy drinks and booze. And I think that social media has amplified that dramatically in terms of the, you know, the need to, as my boys would say, flex and show that you're doing well. Why psychologically do you think people pay so little attention to saving? Because what people don't realize is that wealth creation has got absolutely nothing to do with earning. It's only got to do with saving.
Yeah, exactly. And I've told you this before, but there's a great book in America called The Millionaire Next Door. And it's a book that was written about at least 20 years ago. The Millionaire Next Door, this wealth management company, they tasked an individual to research what is the profile, the demographics of a millionaire, because that was their target market.
Yeah.
And they wanted to have a marketing campaign to attract them. The research was fascinating. And one of the big things coming out of the research, as an example, was that in America, a plumber is more likely to be a dollar millionaire than a lawyer, which you look at that and you kind of go, how can that be?
Yes.
You know, the lawyer's earning 8x what the plumber's earning.
Yes.
But what it comes down to is that wealth is what we don't spend. So one of the challenges we have is we confuse spending with wealth.
Mm.
But savings is invisible and wealth should be invisible. So what you find in America, and it's the same here, we had an interesting situation like that where managing company pension funds, we used to manage company pension funds, some very high earners, like in IT. And then we also managed some lower earners in the trade unions.
Mm.
And what was interesting is that the average employee in the trade union fund had more money saved than the person in technology.
Yeah.
Once again, earning, you know, who knows, 8 times more.
Yeah.
Why is that the case? Well, the case quite simply is that the person in the technology company, while they earn much more, they save much less.
Mm.
So if they're given the option of saving, you know, you can save, let's say, 2% to 15% of your salary. Well, the IT person normally saves 2% because they want to save as little as possible and spend as much as possible. Then when they change jobs, and they change jobs quite frequently, they cash in their pension fund.
Mm.
So they're really poor savers. The person in the trade union, one of the good things the trade unions have done is they have negotiated high contribution rates to pension funds. So they're saving 15% from your first paycheck to your last paycheck.
Yeah.
And when you've got a good job in a unionized company, you don't tend to leave. So you're there your whole working career.
Yeah.
That's the same thing that they saw in the US, the millionaires, is that when you're a lawyer, you hang around with other lawyers. And then it's all about buying the latest car, going on the fanciest overseas holidays, moving house every 3 or 4 years. So your spending was just too high. You know, for every 100 you're earning, you're probably spending 100 and maybe 110. You're going in debt. And whereas if you look at a plumber, like a blue-collar worker, they live in the same house for 50 years. They drive an old car. Their car lasts for 15 years. And it was very interesting. They even went down to, like, what's the most expensive watch that you've ever bought? And what's interesting is that millionaires, on average, spend less on a watch than somebody who is far less wealthy. Now, it's not from a spending perspective, because we'll know people who are quite flashy and they might have a very nice Rolex watch. But outside of mega wealthy people, a lot of millionaires are actually blue collar workers who you wouldn't normally associate that with. So a lot of this is kind of, who do you hang out with? What kind of person are you? Do you have an outer scorecard versus an inner scorecard? I think that's really important, because a lot of us, we should be motivated internally, what is important to us, and peace of mind. I mean, you mentioned Swan. Sleep well at night.
Mm.
I mean, peace of mind, we should value peace of mind highly, which is part of an inner scorecard. Mm. Are we doing things we like? with people we like, as opposed to an outer scorecard where we're trying to impress others.
The fascinating thing there is, while I'm listening, is the notion of balance, because that has to be the key. You don't want to be doing well, the RT guy, and not have experiences like traveling and doing wonderful things, but at the same time, to think about tomorrow and what are the implications of that trip you're going to go, and you know, do you need to fly business class or could you fly economy, or does my child need to go to X school or Y school if the education is equal at both, or do I need to drive that kind of car when I can get power steering and a reverse camera in the other one, a cheaper one as well? How does one think about balance? How does one think about prioritization of spending? Because I think that certainly for the younger generation, and I walk, you know, at the V&A waterfront in Cape Town, which is a shopping center for our listeners overseas, and I see all of these very, very fancy French and Italian brands and people waiting in queues outside. And I'm thinking to myself, well, unless you've got an extraordinary amount of money, do you really need to be buying that? But that pair of whatever the brand might be, Gucci shoes might just be too irresistible to buy. What is your thinking on balance?
It's not an easy one, but I think that we've got to have a good relationship with money. Mm. So I think we need to look at money as not our number one priority in life, but you know, what are the things that bring true happiness? Now, these are always easier things to say than to do. And the younger you are, I think the less you pay attention. But we'll know as parents that saying that the best things in life are free is true.
It is true.
Because for most of us...
Well, certainly, you know, the most important.
Exactly. You know, the birth of your first child, you know, it's just a game-changing experience. And what price do you put on that? What price do you put on your children? What price do you put on family, on friendships, on doing the things you truly love? If you like running or cycling or, you know, whatever it might be, or being out in nature... You know, you can't put a price on those things. So I think it's important to have the right values. And it comes back a little bit to what I said about the outer scorecard versus the inner scorecard. You know, try and have enough self-confidence that you can back yourself. So you don't always have to keep up with whoever is in your peer group. And you don't always have to maybe have the fanciest car. And you've got to have confidence. You've got to have self-confidence. Also, you've got to have gratitude. You've got to be grateful for what you got. You've got to value financial independence. Mm. You've got to value not being under financial stress.
Yeah.
And I think it's something I did touch on earlier, but I've said to my kids is that we live in an affluent neighborhood and there's a lot of affluent people at their school. And they would say to me, well, you know, Dad, XYZ is a lot richer than us because, you know, they've got blah-de-de-blah and they've got this house and this car and whatever, you know. And from a young age, I said to my children, I said, listen, we have no idea how wealthy they are. I haven't seen their bank statement or their balance sheet. I have no interest in that either, but I have no idea. But what we do know is they spend a lot more money than we do. So that I can say, but I've no idea how wealthy they are. And, you know, wealth is something that you don't see, and it's something that gives you, you know, peace of mind.
Yeah. Well, many years ago, a cousin of mine, a Dutch girl, shame, she passed away tragically, but she said to me, money talks and wealth whispers. And I've always liked that expression because, as you say, all it is, means is that they're spending more. Stephen, in your LinkedIn bio, you say that you're doing interesting things with people that you like and respect. What qualifies as interesting to you?
So something's interesting is something that it's a problem that is important that hasn't yet been solved. Mm. Or it's a problem that people think has been solved, but people might think it's been solved incorrectly. There's a better way of doing things.
Yeah.
There's so many things going on in our world,
and
there's so many opportunities. I'd like to be focused on doing things in a commercial sense that it's not just about the money. Mm. It's not just about, is this a good financial opportunity? Is it an interesting opportunity? Is it something that we can, you know, positively impact people's lives? You always want to have a commercial interest because if you want to scale things, if you want to do, you know, positively impact a lot of people, it's like a 10X. At 10X, our objective there was to help people retire with dignity. But we had to do that commercially because if you didn't have enough cash flow to grow the business, then you're not going to impact people.
Yes.
So you've got to balance that commercial side with the purpose and the social good side.
Mm. So if we talk about purpose, you call yourself purpose-driven. What is your purpose?
My purpose from a selfish perspective is to do exactly what you said there, is to do interesting things with people I like. But I believe that if you have something to offer, and you have the ability to offer and positively influence other people, then you should do that. And that's where purpose comes into it. So when I was working at, you know, I was working at an investment bank. I was a managing director of a global investment bank. I flew on the Concorde. I did some, you know, amazing experiences. But to be honest, it was
Hear the Peter Stuyvesant music.
Well, exactly. You know, it's the investment banking is one of those industries where what you see in the movies is kind of the real life.
Yeah.
You know,
the Wolf of Wall Street.
Completely. You know, for better and for worse. But it's kind of the purpose. I didn't feel that I was doing good. Because also one of the reasons why I was interested in finance, which comes back to the earlier question, is that the way that capital is allocated in a country is critically important.
Mm.
So if you look at really what investment comes down to, you what we call a capital allocator, which is if I am saving with my pension fund, where should that money go? And if you allocate that money to good projects and good investments, then you can create a lot of wealth in the economy, a lot of jobs, a lot of wealth for savers, for pension fund, ordinary, you know, people to help them retire with dignity. And that's why I left investment banking. It was phenomenally lucrative and it was great. It was exciting.
Yeah.
And I didn't leave it because it wasn't an exciting, you know, but the purpose wasn't there.
Yeah.
And I felt that at 10X, I could have a far bigger impact on people than I could at a big investment bank.
Mike Abel's book, Willing and Able, Lessons from a Decade in Crisis, captures the stories of clients and partners and the wins, losses, and learnings through his eyes in a career spanning 3 decades. Whether you're looking for courage or inspiration, to learn what it takes to disrupt industries, or discover how to transform your company meaningfully and truly empower your people, you'll find it between these pages. You can listen to the audiobook on Audible, download it on your Kindle, order it online, or find it at your favorite bookstore.
Well, it's very interesting insofar as the investment guy flying on the Concorde versus the client flying on the Concorde. You know, and I often do think how many clients of the investment people can afford to lead the lifestyle of the investment guy, and yet they're the guys that are actually paying for that lifestyle through their investments.
Completely,
which I guess cuts to fees that you spoke about a little bit earlier. But I guess for me, and knowing you well as I do, and you've reminded us in terms of why you changed careers, why it didn't work for you, cuts to values, cuts to who you are and how you want to live your life, not necessarily what you want to have, but what you want to do. And I think people think too little about that. And for our listeners to ask that question of themselves, you know, it isn't really about having, it's about doing. And you might get in the process of doing, but it's in the doing. When you sold and exited 10X Investments as the founder and successful CEO of that company at the end of 2020, actually, you told a newspaper, you said, "I'm very proud of being a force for good in the retirement and investment industry." That obviously then implies that there are forces that are not so good. What was your experience of that?
Well, the reason I started 10X is that I believed that the retirement fund industry was self-serving, did a great job for itself. You mentioned
the people who fly on Concorde.
Yes, yes. There was a book in 1930s called Where Are the Customers' Yachts?
Yeah.
And I don't know if you were referring to that.
No, that's interesting.
Fred Shred. It's a famous book written in the 1930s.
Okay.
It's in New York. And
it's a prescient observation of mine.
It's a very good, exactly. So they were looking in New York and all the customers' yachts, and you know, that belongs to J.P. Morgan, and that's Mr. Stanley's yacht, and you know, and the person said, "Well, we're the customers' yachts because they weren't there."
Those are the customers' yachts.
Yeah, exactly.
They just don't have access to them.
Yeah, so I mean, it's very interesting because early on in my career, I was an analyst on the JSC, and I was covering the life insurance companies, so Liberty, Momentum, Old Mutual. I would ask the CEOs a simple question of all those life companies. Is who's got the best RA, which is a pretty fundamental and simple question, you know, because they've all been in the business for between 50 and 170 years.
So I just want to tell our listeners, an RA is a retirement annuity.
Exactly. So the retirement annuity, the investment product, and you would say, well, who should I go to? If I want to save for my retirement, who should I save with?
Yeah.
Because they've all been around for many, many years and they have millions of investors.
Yeah.
But you have no idea. you don't know who's got the best retirement annuity.
Yeah.
Because they don't want you to know who's got the best retirement annuity, because it's all about the marketing and, as you say, creating these expectations down the line. It's not about the rands and cents. So they all have, once again, it comes to things that sound attractive. So they'll, it used to be, in times gone by, it was that if you were a Liberty Life customer, you'd have a Liberty Life investment product, Old Mutual the same. And even then, you couldn't tell the difference, which would say, well, if you've all got their own product, at least then there should be some kind of scorecard and benchmark.
Yeah.
And then they moved to what they called open architecture, which is let's offer you the best of breed so that you can have the access to the best fund managers. So instead of having maybe five choices, you've now got 1,500 choices.
Yeah.
But no one knows who the best fund manager is. So, you know, it's things like that where the poor customer, the person trying to save for retirement, they are so disempowered. There's so much complexity. They have no idea what to do. And, you know, when I started 10X, what we wanted to try and do is to reverse the model on its head. So even to this day, if you're an individual or you're a CEO of a company and you ask a financial advisor or retirement fund company a simple question like, how should I save for my retirement? It's a simple question that hopefully they would have answered, you know, X million times. But there's a bit of a pause and they go, it depends. You know, it depends. It depends on many things. You know, at the moment, the US may go into recession and there's conflict in the Middle East and, you know, interest rates are high. They might come down. So what they say is, well, we don't know the answer, but here's 1,500 funds to choose from and, you know, give it your best shot. And what we wanted to do at 10X was to turn that on its head, where I said, the industry gives you every option but no solution, and we want to give you a solution with no options. Because there are ways to invest that ensure that you invested appropriately to earn high returns but not take excessive risk, to earn the market return so you're not paying fund managers a lot of fees to underperform, and to pay low fees along the way. And that was sort of the whole essence of 10X. And most retirement fund companies don't do that. They offer you lots of competing choices. And, you know, this year it might be technology's done well, and next year it might be resources, and the year after it might be rand hedges. So they're chopping and changing your portfolio. The investor's got no idea. Most people, if you said to them in a year, how did your retirement fund do? They have no idea. They don't know the number. The number would be, what is the return? The investment company is invariably not telling you the return unless it was a very good year. Then you'll know the return, but otherwise you won't. And even if they said you did 15% return this year, is that good or bad? Well, if the market did 20%, then 15% is not so good. So you know, that was the whole essence of doing good. And unfortunately, retirement products are sold and not bought. So people are still disempowered. Hopefully they're less disempowered. Because I think what we did at 10X is, you know, maybe three things. We gave people confidence to ask simple questions. What should I be doing? You know, with knowing that you should be skeptical, and blind faith is seldom repaid in the investment industry. The second thing is we made people aware of costs. So a lot of people, you know, have become far more aware of the total cost of investing, because that seemingly small fee, while it may not have an impact in 1 year, in the long run, it's devastating. So we made people aware and sensitive to fees, and hopefully negotiating lower fees, because the lower fees, the more money you have and the more that compounds. And the third thing is also be skeptical of fund managers, because 80 or 90% of fund managers underperform the index, and you'd be better off owning a low-cost index fund, no matter how impressive they seem when they talk.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting around the notion of things being opaque and not understanding what they're about. I recall in about 2000, about 24 years ago, when I was co-leading the Ogilvy Group, the late and great Robin Putter, a brilliant ad man, asked me to be the representative of the company. We had 12 companies in the group and 900 people, and he asked me to sit on the retirement, I guess, decision-making board.
Committee.
The retirement committee for the company. And nobody had had any interest in the retirement committee. And it was like, for me, it felt like such an enormous responsibility, because all of a sudden I was responsible for 899 plus myself, 900 people's retirement. And it struck me as being unbelievable almost that there had been so little interest in the decisions that were being made around the people's retirement. Is that a common thing? When you look at companies, do companies obsess themselves with the retirement of their employees? And should employees be asking questions themselves to say, well, what does my retirement look like, as opposed to sitting back thinking that's taken care of? So within my group of companies, I look after, as you know, everybody's retirement with great concern, because I understand how important it is. But there does seem to be an enormous level of apathy within companies about how their employees are going to retire one day. Is that a common feature?
Yeah, it is. If we just look at the history of pension funds, there used to be an obligation on the company to basically provide your pension.
Yeah.
Okay. And what that meant, it was called a defined benefit, but basically what it said is that, you know, for every year's service, you would get, let's say, 2.5% to 3%. Let's keep it simple, 3% of your final salary.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you worked there for 30 years, then you would get 90% of your final salary. The company was obliged to pay that as a pension. So it was a liability. The company had to fund your liability.
That's interesting, yeah.
And that was called defined pensions. And they were wonderful for employees because your pension future was not at risk.
Yes.
The employer took that risk. And the reason the employer assumed that risk is because they have the expertise to work these things out. You know, they've got the technical expertise and the financial expertise to do the best job. The employee would not have that ability. So it was a very clever system.
Yeah.
But then what happened is that companies didn't do a very good job of managing it.
Yes.
You know, it's a bit short-term orientated. So let's not fund the pension enough. We'll have a bit of a pension fund holiday this year because I want to boost company profits and maybe my share options are expiring. So those pensions started to get what we call underfunded. So they weren't managing them very well and their future commitments were increasing relative to the underlying investments to support that. So then you had the pension fund industry with all the pension fund consultants identify a money-making opportunity. And they said, you know what? This defined pension is not very good. Take it off your balance sheet. Give it to the employees. And remarkably, what happened is that the liability was taken away from the company and put on the unsuspecting and unknowing employee who's got no ability, or not no ability, but, you know, far less resources and ability to do a good job of it. So if you went back 30 or 40 years and you sat in a board meeting of a company, the pension fund liability would be a top three item, because it was financially important. Let's ignore the moral.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't have a moral, you didn't feel you had a moral obligation.
Yeah.
Today, it's not even on the agenda. The board has no idea because it's, you know, financially they're not interested. I mean, interested both in the sense of a financial interest and morally having some obligation, which is very, very sad.
Yeah.
You would be on the more unique side of an employer taking, you know, being genuinely concerned and interested to make sure that your employees are getting a good deal.
Which in itself is an indictment of profound...
Unfortunately, unfortunately it is. You know, and if you look in South Africa, I mean, I've engaged with a lot of the pension funds, and there are some companies who do a great job.
Yeah.
They really are. They've got high contribution rates. It's been well managed. They've got a good pension fund committee overseeing it. But unfortunately, that is the exception, not the norm. Most people, no one wants to be on the pension fund committee. So, you know, the senior people aren't there. You know, it's who else can get on is maybe people who may have a good intention, but they're not always have the right skill set to manage it. And we have what we call, you know, it's the tail wagging the dog, is that the pension fund consultant and the investment manager tells you how well you're doing, rather than someone objectively saying, well, actually, you know, are we doing the best we can for our employees?
Some hard questions there that those that are listening should be asking the companies that they work for. Fortunately, you know, I say that without any concern for my company, but I agree. You could ask those questions because that thing that you're contributing every single month that you know so little about is going to make a profound difference to your life one day when you're not in a position to be earning. We're going to now focus a little bit more on you, Stephen. You were a highly rated provincial squash player when you were younger. What did sport at that level teach you, I guess, in applying to your approach to life today? Because you're a very disciplined man. Does it come from sport? Where does it come from? And as you sit in front of me, not that much younger than I am, probably a year maybe, you look in showroom condition. So how does that happen? And what did you learn from those early squash days?
So, yeah, it's an interesting question, Mike, because it's kind of, you know, was my personality, let's say, and some of my characteristics molded by sport? Or did my personality lead me to want to be competitive in sport? And I think it's the former. I think that from a young age, I always wanted to do things well. I always wanted to perform and, you know, growing up as we did in South Africa, sport was a massive
part of our culture.
School was important.
Yes.
But it wasn't kind of critical. You know, you kind of always had a sense that you were going to be okay school-wise, you know, academic-wise, unless maybe you wanted to be a doctor, which I didn't want to be. So sport was everything.
Yeah.
And I always had a desire to play sport at a competitive level and to be good at something and to hopefully play provincially and, you know, who knows, take it further. And so given my personality and wanting to excel, and I loved squash, and it was also, it's an interesting sport because it's one of the few sports that you can play on your own. You know, you can go and practice on a squash court, not like tennis.
Although I did spend many hours against a tennis wall, but yes, I get the point.
It's not exactly the same thing.
No.
So what it taught me is that discipline, perseverance, hard work pays off.
Yeah.
I'll never forget the first tournament I played, I think it was an under 15, the Transvaal under 15 championships at the old Hillbrow Squash Center, which I don't know, I'm sure some listeners will remember. It was a magnificent center, squash center in Hillbrow. I played the number one seed, the number one in South Africa, and he absolutely killed me. And I was bouncing off the walls because I was trying so hard, but my skill was just, you know, very poor.
Yeah.
My determination was way ahead of my skill level. Yeah. And, you know, I lost 3-love and I came off and I was absolutely exhausted. And, you know, but it taught me, keep on persevering. You've got to come back. You've got to fight. You've got to learn. You've got to improve. And a few years later, I actually beat that person to win the South African Under 19 Championships.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, a phenomenal feeling and one of pride. So I think sport, it's about discipline.
Yeah.
I also, you know,
resilience.
Fortunately, I wasn't very talented. I mean, I was good, but I wasn't super talented. And why I say fortunately, from two reasons. The one is I had to work hard. So I had to work a lot harder than other people.
Mm.
And secondly, I was never that good that I could go professional.
Mm.
And professional squash is not really a career.
Mm.
So it was kind of, I was in quite a good sweet spot
where
I had to work really hard, but I was never going to be that good that I could be a world beater. And I met amazing people. And I think that's another big thing is you meet people. Also, when you're playing sport, you meet people of different ages.
Mm.
So I was at school and I was playing in the men's league, you know, and then I would be engaging with much older people.
Mm.
And I've always had a bit of a skepticism towards authority. And I think, Mark, this is where I think you might have a similar affliction.
Innocent as charged.
You might have. And, you know, I'll never forget we played against the teachers' college.
Yes.
So I was a schoolboy and I was playing as a teachers' college. And then all of a sudden you're on the same level. You know, it's no longer a teacher. Exactly. Teacher pupil. Exactly. It's first names. You know, it's no longer Mr. Abel. It's Mike. The person says, what school are you at? And I told them the school. And then he said, oh, is this person a teacher there? And he said, yeah. It was a teacher who I didn't like.
Mm.
You know, and he said, well, you know, that guy's an absolute, got to be careful what I say on your show here, you know, but.
Knob.
Exactly. Yeah. And I said, that's right. You know, he is.
Yeah.
But it was like so liberating and empowering that, you know, you could actually have that kind of a conversation.
Yeah.
So the network's been amazing. Just, you know, meeting great people along the way. And even a lot of the friends I have today, and even from a business perspective, you know, are my squash friends from, who knows, 35 years ago.
Yeah. What I love about that story as well is that you didn't say when you came off the court when you were 15 that you were gutted. You came off realizing that that person was better than you, that there was a lot that you could learn from that person, and that you were actually inspired to take those lessons and to master it to beat that person 4 years later at 19. And I think a lot of people look at adversity in the moment as a defining moment. And maybe it is a defining moment, but for you it was a defining moment for growth, not for retreat. And I think that's, for me, one of the most important things in my life. You know, a company that, so when I applied to work at Ogilvy Cape Town as a graduate trainee, I was declined. I wasn't accepted for the graduate trainee program. And then they had to come and headhunt me 2 years later when I was working at an agency in Johannesburg to come and work for them. And then a few years later, I was the managing director of the company. If I had taken that rejection to heart and thought, well, I'm not good enough for this company, I realized it was more a factor of their poor taste and judgment than my talent. And whether it was or wasn't is a separate matter altogether. But I do think that when you have these challenges in your moment, and that is something that you've reminded me in terms of sport particularly, is just that it teaches you resilience to bounce back. Do you think the fact that squash is not a team sport, but something where you are responsible entirely for yourself, for your performance, was something that mattered? Or was it just something that you gravitated to automatically?
Yeah, so I think that firstly, I like to, and certainly at that stage, I like to rely on myself more than others. So I'm kind of saying, let me rely on myself, let me back myself.
Yes.
Not that I mean, I enjoy team sports.
Yeah.
But it was more a thing of, this is something I can do myself. I can train when I want to. I can get up when I want to. I don't have to rely on, you know, 5 or 10 other people getting together.
Mm.
So I like that aspect of it.
Yeah.
But I think if you look at all individual sports, those individual sportsmen love team sports sometimes more. So if you look at Davis Cup would be a good example.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at golf, you look at Ryder Cup, you know, those golfers are more pumped up and they're more, you know, excited when they're playing in the team.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, ultimately we love people. I think being part of a community and a team gives more satisfaction. And if you're playing an individual sport where you don't have that team around you, you probably value it more. So I did have, at squash, we did play provincial, which was team events, and there's a lot of fun. So I think it's about a balance. But I wanted to come back, Mark, what you said about sort of adversity. You know, it's really important, and it's important at all ages, especially I think for our children, where if you're in an environment where everything's paved for you and every minor hiccup you have as a child, you know, your parent, if you're not in the right school team or the right class or the right this or the right that, you know, your parent, I think they call it a helicopter parent these days, of which there are, unfortunately, more than there should be.
Yeah.
The child never experiences any adversity. And the first time they do experience adversity, it's so devastating to them. So like with my kids, I try and let them experience adversity and let them know they're going to experience adversity. And I think a lot of people have become too soft. I think society has become too soft where we say life should be fair and it's unfair. And life is unfair. Not always the best people get selected and there might be prejudice and bias. But if you have an attitude that life is unfair and when something happens to you, you go, yeah, life is unfair. You're never going to reach your full potential. And you're never going to break through those glass ceilings. And I think sport teaches you that.
Absolutely.
The Street Store turns 10 this year. The world's first rent-free, premises-free, free pop-up store provides a dignified shopping experience to those in need, allowing them to choose from a selection of pre-loved clothing and shoes. Over 1,000 stores have been hosted around the world in the past decade. And now we're calling on you to host your own. Visit thestreetstore.org to sign up and find out how.
While you're speaking, I'm reminded of the old kind of ancient religious wisdoms of the Kabbalah, or the Kabbalah, as the Americans say, where there's a line that says, challenge is your only opportunity for growth. And what that means is that without challenge, you can't grow. And as parents, that is what we today have been taught, is to remove every obstacle from our children's lives. I think I've touched on this maybe in another podcast where I said, Margaret Thatcher says she was born with two distinct advantages. She had good parents and they were poor. I think one of the greatest fears, you know, I think a lot of us are motivated by hope and a lot of us are motivated by fear or any combination thereof. And I grew up in a home where it was feast or famine in terms of my father and his career. Either his shops were booming because he had retail shops when the economy was strong, or they were in a dire situation. And fortunately for my very brilliant and successful grandfather, he just made sure that things carried on along on an even keel, whether it was boom or bust. But I did look at that as a kid and I thought, I never want that level of uncertainty for myself. My dad was one of the world's great optimists and an incredible dad and a wonderful human being, but he was a Walter Mitty. He was like a bit detached from the reality. He kind of thought that if he thought things would go well, they would go well. So I think that those childhood things that you refer to, they do in many ways shape it. And I think that what I've been working for 35 years, and in 35 years, I've literally worked for 3 companies in that entire time. And I think that most of it, I think, has been led by hope. But I think there has also been a degree that's been led by fear, of uncertainty, of a lack of predictability, of removing barriers from our own life. In your vast career, you must have learned an enormous amount about human nature. What would you say about human nature you still don't understand?
people are complex.
Yeah.
And I think that there's degree to their complexity. You know, some people, what you see is more or less what you get, and other people, it's the complete opposite. I think I've learned to try and empathize more and to try and put myself in that person's position. So before I judge someone, or maybe not before, because I think your first instinct is to judge.
Yeah.
But let's say you judge them unfavorably for whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Is to try and put myself in their shoes and try and understand where they are coming from. But people are wonderful and people are terrible. It's the same thing. I remember in 2010, I interviewed John Bogle. And John Bogle in the United States, in Boston, he is the founder of Vanguard.
Yeah.
And Vanguard is the biggest investment company in the world. It's an absolute behemoth, and he's a legend.
Yeah.
Shame he passed away. You know, he's all about simple, low-cost investing, and he shuns all these hedge funds and complex, expensive products. And I asked him, I said, what is your view on hedge funds?
Yes.
And I was expecting him to say to me, they're terrible. And he said, well, you know, that's like asking me how do I feel about people. Some of them are good and some of them are bad. I think it's about trying to have a better understanding of people and be less judgmental and try and be more inclusive and try and see things from their side. It's interesting when you're running a company, you know, one of the things is when people aren't performing in line with the culture or expectations, how much should you do to bring them up? And, you know, that's, you know, how do you invest in people? And I've had experiences where when you invest in people, you know, some people you invest in, you are able to turn them around and get much better results. And some people, it's very difficult. So it's almost as if you're not going to be able to, you know, influence people. And I think that's the same in life. And maybe one thing that was interesting for me is when I was running research in South Africa for Deutsche Bank, I was also responsible for handing out bonuses to our research team. And the bonuses were sizable. I mean, a lot of money was made. There would always be a bonus day, and we'd sit down with the various team members and you'd tell them their bonus. And it was like playing poker, because the very successful analysts, the number one rated analysts, you know, they would have expectations of very high bonuses. And I would sit down, and I can still see it to this day. You tell the person what their bonus is, and the higher the bonus, so the more people were paid, the less positive response you got. So you'd say to them, you know, you got X million, which was an astounding amount of money.
You know, the minute you just mentioned X million,
exactly.
You're talking about 15 years ago.
Exactly, No, it's big, you know, and they would just look at you. There wouldn't be a thank you, not that we didn't have to thank me, but on behalf of the company, you know, you can thank me on behalf of the company.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they would just go, then you're trying to say, well, are you happy with that? You know, you don't want to be unhappy, you know, you're happy. It's fine. It's okay. It's in line with, you know, it's at the bottom end of my expectations, but, I probably won't leave. I'll probably, I'll probably do you a favor and spend another year here. And you're going through this process. And then our executive assistant who got the bonus, and, you know, her bonus was the lowest bonus by
a country mile.
And I said, Alison, this is your bonus. And she stopped breathing and she went, I actually thought she was going to have a heart attack. She was so emotional that, you know, it made a big difference in her life. Kind of taught me a very good lesson about, you know, people, their relationship with money, their reactions to money. It was a good microcosm of, you know, what goes on in society as well.
Well, you know, you spoke a little bit earlier about gratitude, and not necessarily, I guess, that one needs to be grateful or not grateful for a bonus per se, but for what that means in your life, what you can do with it, what the difference would be. And how sad it is that somebody that's getting a lot of money is dissatisfied, and somebody who's getting a little bit of money, but in their lives transformative money, has a much richer experience of that moment. There's a big lesson there, which brings me to my next question, which does cut to understanding people better and human psychology. So you're now involved with Sense, a disruptive market research company, as well as an innovative healthcare company in the States with a mission to transform the global healthcare industry. What are you hoping to disrupt and to transform through these two ventures?
Well, let's start with Sense. I mean, Sense, I think, you know, market research in and of itself, I mean, it's interesting, but for me, it's not that, I'm not superbly interested in market research. But what I'm interested in with Sense is their ability to disrupt that industry in a sizable and scalable way. So you say, I'm not sure if you've spoken about this before, but, you know, sends...
I haven't, not on this podcast series.
Okay, so here we go. Let's see. Is about, let's call it 70% of what people actually think is nonverbal. So what they tell you and what they write in a questionnaire is not what they fundamentally believe. And I think what's fascinating is to use technology, be it through voice, tonality, pitch, body language, and just the way people talk. So to use those nonverbal cues with technology to get deeper insights, I think is fascinating because it gives people a voice and maybe their true voice that they might be afraid to express. So I think that, you know, marrying that technology and getting far bigger insights and then the ability to do that at scale.
Yeah.
So we use avatars in Sense. So it's not a person, but it looks like a person and it's a person that you can relate to and you're far more comfortable. So you're scaling deeper insights and then you can give people a voice for other things. So you can get marginalized communities who may not have a voice because it's inaccessible and it's too expensive to do research into what actually matters to people. Let's say, you know, disadvantaged people, they might be whatever in a rural area, they might not have access to running water or they might be in a township, but we can't actually get to understand their problems and what is important to them. So I think Sense has got that very interesting ability to do that. And it's the technology behind it is very, very interesting.
And our people are going to say, well, Stephen, if they don't have access to running water, what access do they have to Sense research? And I think that's the point at which you say, well, there is practically 100% smartphone penetration in South Africa. And how I think the technology and mobile phones, if you like, I mean, whether they're mobile phones or not is another thing because you'd almost do everything else on it except for make phone calls. But I think that technology does unlock a myriad of opportunities for growth in South Africa and new solutions. And new solutions obviously come from unexpected sources. Old solutions come from expected sources. The voices that you don't hear often to get to new solutions. So if you then look at your healthcare company, how different is that in terms of what you're trying to do?
So I know close to zero about healthcare.
Yes.
But through a friend, a former South African who's been living in the US for over 35 years, he was a former professional tennis player. His name's Mark Kaplan. He actually played in the final of the SA Open against Wayne Ferreira the one year. A healthy guy in his 50s, had a heart attack, rushed to hospital, two stents put in his heart. His cardiologist diagnosed him with high cholesterol, high plaque, and said it's hereditary. You must take statins. Took statins. Felt terrible, couldn't get out of bed after 6 months, and he decided to seek alternative cardiologists who didn't believe that statins or didn't believe that cholesterol was the cause of heart disease, a main risk factor, and there were other risk factors, primarily being insulin resistance, and it's kind of your intolerance to carbohydrates. Anyway, long story short, he fired his cardiologist, and he got a new team, and it took him 18 months, but he got himself right, and he got back on, he's the same weight now that he was on the ATP tour. His energy is phenomenal. His brain fog was cleared. It was transformative. It was a real game changer for him. And then he decided that there are all of these what are called metabolic health doctors around the world that are practicing this type of medicine, which is very much, you know, when we talk about metabolic health, we're talking about our metabolism, which is our ability to process what goes into our body to give us energy.
Yeah.
And if you think about how our diet has changed, you know, what we're eating, a lot of toxins are going into our body and that causes many of us to be insulin resistant. And that is the root cause of many chronic diseases. It's quite fascinating. So if you look at obesity and type 2 diabetes and Alzheimer's and cardiovascular disease, one of the main root causes of all of those diseases is poor metabolic health.
Mm.
And so what we're doing is we are consolidating all these metabolic health doctors. So they might be GPs, internal medicine, radiologists, cardiologists, health coaches, nutritionists. And we're trying to scale metabolic health because it's all about preventative healthcare. And the similarity with the healthcare industry and with the investment industry is conflicts of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is, I don't know how much time we got, Mark, but this could be topic for another day. Because if you think of a healthcare industry, it's a sick care industry. The industry only makes money if you're sick.
Yeah.
So if I'm sick, I'm going to need pharmaceuticals, I'm going to need medication, I'm going to, you know, need blood work done, I'm going to go to hospital.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm healthy, who's going to make money off me? It's very, very interesting. And as a bit of a contentious point over here, I'll give you an example. You know, if you look at like Discovery,
yeah.
You know, so Discovery is a phenomenal company and they have innovated a lot. But Discovery, you know, one of their goals is to make people healthier.
Yeah.
I think.
I think so.
Probably like the main vitality. That's what you associate with them.
Driving good behaviors towards health.
Exactly. Okay. So people are healthier. It means that they're going to spend less on healthcare.
Yeah.
Which means that your medical aid premium should come down. Because your medical aid contribution, Discovery can only make a fixed percentage of whatever your premium is. Let's say 15%. That's all they can make. But if you're healthy, then I'm going to spend less on my medical. So my medical aid contribution is going to fall. But if it falls, then Discovery makes 15% of a smaller contribution. Mm. They make less money. It's not going to be a very good business model.
Mm.
And as brilliant as Discovery is in terms of, you know, the vitality and making people healthier and their sheer size, they are so much bigger than anyone else. They're not cheaper. It's the same medical aid contribution, more or less. It's the same as in the US where they have health insurance. So there's a lot of vested interests that aren't necessarily interested in making us as patients, consumers, healthier. And if you look at the trends of obesity and type 2 diabetes, the risk and the prevalence of that is increasing dramatically. So the more we're spending on healthcare, the actual healthcare outcomes are getting worse. And that's what we're trying to address at HealthQuest.
Well, that's very fascinating to consider. But what I like about any life company that does try and drive good behaviors is at least they're trying to do that as opposed to being more vested in sickness than they are in health. I kind of want to gravitate a little bit towards the ones that are more vested in health.
Now, Discovery's doing a great job. Don't get me wrong. They, you know, their vitality program and, as you say, encouraging people to exercise. But there is a commercial interest, which is interesting to think about.
Yeah. Very interesting. Very interesting. The other thing I'm going to come back to and pick your mind about later is statins, because I am on a statin for my cholesterol. And if there's a way of solving that problem without one, I'd be delighted to hear.
Mike, is there a point in the show where we say this is not medical advice? Consult your physician.
Absolutely.
This is not financial advice.
We are having a conversation. We're not telling people what to do with their retirement. We're not telling people what to do with their research, with their heart, anything else. But you're a wise man, and I appreciate your honesty around that. So we're now in the home stretch of our conversation, and these conversations are designed to empower, I guess, our listeners to make smarter decisions about their lives or to have aha moments or even to strongly disagree with what we are saying. Because why do two people need to agree on everything? Because, as they say, then you only need one of them. But Stephen, I have great respect and admiration for your thought processes, as you know, and you as a person, a human. If you were to give a 21-year-old, as your final question from me, just one piece of advice, financial or otherwise, what would that one piece of advice be?
It would be to trust yourself and to back yourself and be skeptical. Maybe inquisitive is a better word. These days, you've got access to so much great information. Finding information is not always that easy because you've got to look at the source. I think there's enough credible information out there for people to back themselves. And if it comes to sort of, as an example, finance. So if it comes to finance, you know, I'd say to them, do not listen to Bloomberg or CNBC. If you watch the financial news, you might think that you're learning something about finance, but you're not. It's very short-term orientated. People are mostly hysterical. They're trying to confuse and disempower you. And the more that I listen to those programs, the worse I am as an investor. But I could find out what are the strong principles of investing.
Yeah.
You know, and then you say, learn from successful people. What's amazing with investing is you've got someone called Warren Buffett, who we all know well by now.
All 98 years of him.
I think he's 93 or 4.
You know,
still stays in the same house. I visited that house in 2007. Same house in Omaha, which is a very average house in Omaha. He still works every day in the same office. You know, that's happiness. So he's, you know, it's not about the money. It's about the joy he gets out of it. But you can go on YouTube and you can Google Warren Buffett's best investment advice. And not only will Warren Buffett give you brilliant investment advice, he'll give you brilliant life advice, you know, who to hang out with, who your peer should be. But somehow people don't gravitate there. If you look at Warren Buffett's best investment advice, you'll see a YouTube video that might have 50,000 views, you know, and then you'll see some arbitrary person, I don't know, doing some arbitrary thing and they'll have 200 million views.
Mm.
So I think people have got to invest more in themselves and back themselves.
So be more discerning about what you look for and take in.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's so much shit being thrown at people every single day on social media, particularly on things like TikTok and all of the like.
Yeah.
None of which is believable, really, or very little. Most of it's divisive nonsense. Rather invest your time in quality endeavors. I mean, it's funny you say that because a number of years ago I was doing a talk and I wanted to hear a bit of wisdom about civilization and humanity from one of the greatest minds of our time, Stephen Hawking, to your exact point. And I went onto YouTube and he was talking about life and the universe and our future civilization. And over a 5-year period, I think it was about 1.7 million people had watched it. And then I did a bit more searching and I saw 26 million people had watched a dormouse snoring in a girl's hand. I think a greater number had watched a girl crying about how much she loved her cats. I think about 700 million people have watched Miley Cyrus come in on her wrecking ball, and over 2 billion people had watched Sars Gangnam Style. And it was astonishing to me, exactly corroborating what you're saying. So I do think for our listeners is spend time absorbing and listening to brilliant people like a Warren Buffett, because they've got sage wisdom, and they once in a generation, once in a lifetime, people to learn from. So,
and also if you read a good book or something,
yeah.
If you know, so if you want to understand investing,
yeah.
What I used to do is give people John Bogle's book called The Little Book of Common Sense Investing.
Yeah.
It's a very easy read. It might be 150 pages, but they're not thick pages. Now, if you read that book, you will have a very good understanding.
The Little Book of Common Sense Investing.
Yeah. Okay. Wiley's the publisher. Little Book of Common Sense Investing. Fantastic. Easy, easy read. And that book will explain to you investing. It'll explain the principles of investing, how to make investing work for you, the impact of fees, not chasing the biggest fad, how to save properly, responsibly. You know, you'll read that book. It might take, I don't know, 4 hours maybe. You know, okay. Maybe you read it twice because and also you'll get to the principles, you know, and you spend that time and you'll have a foundation that will be with you forever.
Yeah.
Whereas what people will do is they'll spend more than that 8 hours on nonsense, maybe sitting in front of CNBC,
scrolling.
You know, watching someone talk about the latest inflation figure, and now we've got the non-farm payrolls coming. It's all meaningless. It's just meaningless, you know, but you sit there and you're lazy and it's,
Well, we're going to close on that, and I'm going to throw another book in that you gave me about 2 years ago to read, which was, I think, called The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel.
Yes.
I thought that was an outstanding book as
Fantastic.
Well. So maybe you read those two books.
Without a doubt. I gave that to my 19-year-old son to read in his vacation, Sam. I said, you read this book.
Good. Well, we'll come to Sam for financial advice in a few years. Stephen, it's been absolutely fantastic to chat to you today. Thanks so much for sharing your invaluable time with me and giving our listeners such food for thought.
Thanks, Mark. It's a lot of fun. I know it's gonna happen.
Thanks so much for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not leave us a 5-star review? Tune in to Willing and Able next time for more conversations that challenge perspectives.
This podcast is produced by Two Stories, written by Linda Scarborough, produced by Carol Williams, with audio editing, engineering, and sound design by Kozim Zimela, with production assistance from MNC Saatchi Group South Africa's team, Maciek Dubla and Nadia Siegel. Special thanks to Sonic Nursery and Edible Audio for the recording of these episodes.